ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Today on Future Tense, the cultural cost of dealing with big media, the fading face of Australian drama, trying to negotiate reason with the big streaming companies, and almost a year on, how Canadians have dealt with the absence of serious professional news content on Facebook and Instagram, and what can we learn from their experience? Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Let's go first to the ban by Facebook's parent company, Meta, and Angus Bridgman, the director of the Media Ecosystem Observatory, a joint initiative run by McGill University and the University of Toronto.
The observatory was started about 5 years ago in Canada, and the goal of the observatory is to try to monitor and understand what we call the information ecosystem, so the way information kind of moves around in online and offline spaces. This sort of comes out of a lot of the research, particularly concerned about mis and disinformation and foreign interference, as well as some of the other sort of problems with online spaces, for example, already marginalized voices sort of fleeing online spaces because of harassment and other things. So we're trying to sort of understand the constellation of online harms, as well as some of the advantages.
And one of the observatory's principal tasks over the past half year has been to try and understand the impact that Meta's news ban has had on Canadian society and its democracy. It's an issue that has resonance in Australia because Meta has already indicated it intends to stop paying Aussie news sites for their content. And that means a news ban down under is also possible.
At the observatory, we canvassed to try to understand the number of online outlets, and we came up with about 1,050 that are Canadian-based. Some of them are very small regional, up to sort of the large national players. The vast majority of them have been blocked. Not everyone. A few of them have slipped through kind of the list that was compiled on Meta's end, but almost all outlets have been blocked. What we've seen is a drop of approximately 90% of pre-ban engagement. So there's still some international consumption of Canadian news, but I think we're in kind of a similar situation in Australia where the primary market is domestic. And so what you've seen is really that drop of about 90%. That reduces click-through. It has a real heavy impact on the bottom line. We've seen some outlets go dark entirely. Some outlets have been cut off completely from the socially kind of connected web. And so you've seen quite major kind of impacts. This comes at a time when journalism and the production of high-quality news is already kind of been challenged by economic forces and political forces over the last several years. So it's not coming at a great time, and many are concerned about sort of the health of the industry in Canada.
And this ban, as you say, covers Facebook and Instagram. Looking at the users of those two social media platforms, what's been their response and how have they dealt with this loss of news content?
Yeah, so what's really important to note is that in addition to collecting digital trace data or social media data, we also collect survey data. And those two platforms are number one and number three for Canadians receiving political information. They were in sort of the pre-ban period. They actually continue to be some of the top social media platforms. What we've seen really across the board is a collective shrug by users to the reduction of sort of what we'd say is hard news on the platform. That is to say, many users have not noticed. Many users are still continuing to say they're getting their news from these platforms. And we've done a whole range of sort of comparison and empirical tests to try to understand whether or not there's been what we would call any substitution. So whether or not users are moving to other platforms to get their news or users are going to other types of accounts to get their news. And what we see is really flatlined on all of that. So the net result really is that Canadian consumers are now no longer being exposed in what we would say is an incidental way, which is to say, as they're sort of on social media platforms browsing other types of content they're interested in, they used to get exposed to the news at a fairly high rate, and now that's just not happening. So what we're seeing is just sort of a less informed population, a population that is getting less of that hard news. And so far, consumers haven't seemed to really respond to this in any sort of, they haven't left the platform, they haven't really adjusted their behavior.
Does that mean, or does that reinforce the idea that we've overestimated in the past how interested people are in news and how much news they actually do consume?
It's a complicated phenomenon. I think people want to feel that they are informed about the world going on around them. They don't need to read every news article or be avid consumers of the day-to-day political life. But I think generally, Canadians, those we survey, still want and do often feel that they have some sense of the political world. And so it's really, when you measure active news consumption, it's very low. But one of the powers of social media, one of the real powers that it, and it still serves this function on non-Meta platforms, is you get exposed to the news whether or not you like it. There is some percentage of your feed which does contain accurate, true, verifiable information from news outlets, from politicians, from trusted sources, and you get exposed. And so you get this feeling of being informed, and maybe you do have some sort of sense of what's going on. And I think that that's actually the greatest cost here, is that that kind of disappears. And so there is no more incidental exposure. But if you still have people saying, oh yeah, I'm still informed, but they're not getting any sort of day-to-day exposure to information, again, sort of highlighting a real challenge here, and something that I think is going to be the most significant consequence other than sort of the financial impact for Canadian news outlets. The other piece is just folks are locked into the platform of choice. They've spent years using a platform. They're familiar with the interface. They're familiar with their network. That's their social presence. They use Facebook or Instagram. And just removing news is maybe not a big enough change to their feed to have them seek out news on like Twitter or X or TikTok or Snapchat, which are all platforms with a steep learning curve and their own kind of eccentricities. And so this is sort of, I think, one of the points of the Canadian government is that there's a strong monopoly power here. And so there isn't sort of an easy substitute. If the quality of the product goes down, that is to say your feed is providing you with less information, it's not obvious where you would go to sort of get better information.
Looking at the majority of people, though, who still say that they're getting their news from Facebook or Instagram, does that mean that the news that they think they're getting is not necessarily going to be, or is not going to be, from a professional or a reputable source?
It will certainly be mediated. So we're doing a study on this right now. We're working on a big study for a one-year retrospective of the ban. One of the things we really want to understand in that one-year study is, what do people mean when they say they're getting the news? And we have some suspicions, things like, if you're getting information about a local sports team, maybe you count that as news. If you're getting information about sort of a, like an influencer on the platform or from a politician about sort of a local farmer's market or whatever, there's still some news content that's happening there. And then I think the other thing that often gets missed in these conversations is that generally the population is inattentive to news. They don't read that much news. They don't care that much about news. They'll follow key stories at important moments, but otherwise won't pay attention. And so in this case, I suspect a lot of Canadians haven't even noticed that they're not getting that high-quality news. It was a small part of their feed before, now it's gone, but they're still getting the types of information that they typically would get on the platform, and so their experience has not changed, and so they're still saying they're getting the news. The implications of that for democracy are pretty severe when we say that the majority of Canadians now say they get their news from social media, and if they were relying on the idea that the news would find them on these platforms if it was important, which is something that's sort of widespread, is the sense that, oh yeah, if something important happens, somebody will tell me, right? I don't need to seek out the news. Well, maybe now in the post-ban world, they're actually not getting that information and they're under the impression that they're being informed when actually they're not being informed. And that can be quite disastrous for a democracy, which relies on an informed population. People are often very concerned about this rising misinformation, this notion that now on these platforms there's a flood of false information. What our study kind of shows to a certain extent is that it's actually the other problem. It's not that there's now a flood of bad information. That bad information was always there. It's the good information that has been turned off, the information that allows people to be informed. And so when people say, like, we're really concerned about people being misinformed, misinformed is one thing, but completely uninformed is another and also extremely serious problem. And I think that's really what's going on here is over time, what we're going to see amongst Canadians who primarily rely on Instagram and Facebook, which there are many, are going to become more and more uninformed, maybe a little bit more misinformed, but it's that uninformed and that complete lack of interest, lack of appreciation of sort of the complexity of the political world. That's potentially very worrying.
Angus Bridgman, the director of the Media Ecosystem Observatory at McGill University and the University of Toronto. And we should just mention that in a recent submission to an Australian parliamentary inquiry, Meta disputed the idea that its news ban had led to more misinformation being spread on its Canadian platforms. Now, to global media giants of another kind and their impact on Australian culture and streaming content. Last year, the Australian government acknowledged a problem with the amount of local content being produced by the big streaming services like Netflix and Paramount+. And the government indicated that by the beginning of July this year, they'd have content quotas in place. But that deadline has come and gone, and there are still no requirements to ensure that the streamers who operate in Australia actually make films and series with an Australian theme. Matthew Diener is the CEO of the Screen Producers Association, and he says the lack of local commissioning is hurting the Australian film and television industry and putting at risk its future viability.
So our members are businesses that create the work. They're production companies that go about hiring all the talent, the writing team, the directors, and eventually actors and, you know, investments that come from all of those people in order to make the whole production happen. But there's usually a sort of a two-year, maybe 18-month, depending on what sort of show, lag between when people are talking to people and starting the process of production or development as to when you start to see something on screen. So the problem starts happening pretty early in our industry when there isn't the exchange of commissioning conversations, the ideas that are being usually bounced around, the kind of development drafts of things. People can tell pretty early on that there's a problem. You know, the flow-on effect is that people ultimately, in an industry level, will not have as much work. And from an audience level, they'll stop seeing the quantity and quality of programming that they've been used to over the last few years.
Take us through the equation in terms of how much money the big US streaming services make in Australia, as opposed to what they're spending on local content.
Different businesses are doing different things, and the quantity of investment has changed over, I think, the last few years versus their earnings. I think it's a well-known fact that Netflix is earning about $1 billion in revenue, and they're probably the most significant drawer of revenues from Australia. Netflix is one of about five or six businesses. They'd be making probably aggregated about $4 billion a year, and they're putting in maybe to new Australian content, pure newly Australian content, about a couple of hundred million. It's a pretty low ratio, we think, in terms of earnings and levels of investment. And it's the reason why when we've looked to other territories internationally as an example, as a bit of a beacon of going, well, what are they doing about this? We've seen some of the best examples where they've investing back into the territory over 20% of their earnings to continue to keep the whole ecosystem going. And this isn't sort of a tax that goes to something else. It's actually an investment in their own product that appears on their service. So that's essentially why you have these sort of regulations in play.
Now, the Albanese government recognised when they came in that there was an issue here. They gave a commitment to introduce a content quota system for streaming services in Australia. That was, as I understand it, meant to come down in early July. That hasn't happened, obviously. So what's happened and where do you think they're going from here?
Look, it's a source of great concern to the sector because we've had this date, I should say, the 1st of July 2024, as the date when the whole scheme is meant to commence. And that was promised in the revive policy of 2023, the start of 2023. That is the target the government gave itself. And that leaves a problem for us in that the legislation hasn't been tabled. We understand it hasn't been finalised in terms of the actual policy framework. And there's, you know, only really a handful of sitting weeks left in this year. And then we have a federal government election at some point in this process. And the challenge, you know, for any government in this environment is twofold. The first is you're dealing with a domestic media industry, which people are nervous around. And then we're also dealing now with global tech businesses, content tech that's sort of merging to the same thing, that are coming from the United States. And those businesses are the biggest businesses globally, not for the faint-hearted in terms of going toe-to-toe with. We've seen what happens when governments try to engage in the past with Facebook about the media bargaining code and the consequences of the noses being thumbed to the governments. So you've got to be very careful about those relationships. And when the United States is in election mode as well, those businesses can lean on the big, you know, relationship of the United States to help drive a conversation that's in their interests. And of course, we're dealing with individual creative people that are trying to provide the other side of that coin. So it's very complicated. And I dare say that is the undercurrent as to why it is that this isn't moving as fast as happened. So, you know, all of that is happening at the moment and it's creating a reasonable amount of angst between different participants in the industry.
And just picking up on the global aspect of what you've just said, this is not an issue that Australia is dealing with alone, is it? I mean, these big streaming services like the big social media platforms are really trying it on with various governments around the world.
That's right. I mean, that is what is fascinating really at this point. So Europe got in very fast in this, 2017, and Europe is a obviously very big entity, can probably go toe-to-toe with the United States and those businesses more easily than an individual market or economy the size of Australia. So that happened a while ago. And the reason we talk about 20% is that France is at 25.5%, Germany's signaled 20%, Italy's at, you know, close level, and there are many others that are at smaller levels. Canada and Australia are the two countries that are the most closest to setting up proper frameworks with the streamers, but that is being fought very vigorously because there's a contagion, of course, that happens if other countries other than Europe, which they're wanting to wind back, start to do this regulation. So strategically, we're a very important territory for them to not let anything of significance happen. And in Canada, there was an announcement a number of weeks ago that there was a stage one of a 5% revenue commitment. So in other words, the businesses would need to start to contribute 5% of their earnings into a fund that would then be used to support news and other services, including Indigenous content. And that was before the second iteration of their regulation was to happen, which was particularly about Canadian content, which is really what we're talking about in the Australian situation. And a number of days ago, just a handful of days ago, a whole heap of lawsuits were provided to the Canadian regulator from these businesses fighting against that decision to have to do 5%. So in other words, they're resisting even the stage one of what will be a regulatory framework, and they're fighting it tooth and nail, and they're doing it again in the same sort of context as Australia is needing to stand up for itself. But, you know, I think there is a pathway here, and there has to be strength of a government commitment to stand up for Australian culture.
Matthew Diener, and Matthew is the CEO of the Screen Producers Association. Now, it's not just the streaming services that are being questioned about their commitment to quality Australian content. Traditional free-to-air broadcasters are also in the spotlight. Researchers at the Queensland University of Technology have just published a report entitled Australian Television Drama's Uncertain Future: How Cultural Policy is Failing Australians. Anna Potter, Professor of Digital Media and Cultural Studies at QUT.
Well, it's a four-year study looking at the production primarily of Australian television drama. And the key takeaway from our report is that levels of Australian drama production have fallen catastrophically since the early 2000s, down about 55% since 2001. And the impact of that, both for the industry, but particularly for the Australian community, given that Australian drama is considered to hold a particularly special place in fostering a sense of national cultural representation.
And what have been the main reasons for that decline?
Principally, the removal of content quotas from commercial broadcasters, or the effective removal of Australian drama content quotas from commercial broadcasters. They've had kind of two waves of disruption. First of all, multi-channeling, that meant that they had to launch multiple new channels with static amounts of advertising revenue. So their programming costs went up, but they didn't have any extra ad revenue. And then that fragmented their audiences across these new channels. So their business model that's built on mass audiences is completely eroded. So they're trying to save money on programming costs. And then they get a second wave of disruption with streamers entering the market from around 2015. And so for them, Australian drama has become too expensive relative to the advertising revenue it can attract. It's much better for a commercial broadcaster to put to air reality TV or sport or news and current affairs than high-cost scripted content like Australian drama. And the previous government was extremely accommodating to their requests and lobbying efforts to have those drama quotas watered down to the extent that now you can satisfy all your drama requirements with a single series of Neighbours or Home and Away. Whereas in the past, all three commercial broadcasters had to invest in around 100 hours of new Australian drama each year. And that's when we see those long-running series, the sort of Blue Heelers and A Country Practice and All Saints, you know, those big volume year after year commercial broadcasting shows, gone.
So given the parlous state of commercial television, is it unlikely that any kind of quota system would be introduced by the government to try and boost drama in Australia on commercial free-to-air television?
I doubt that the political will exists to prosecute the case for putting quotas back on commercial broadcasters who, for all that their business model is under a lot of pressure, still wield an awful lot of social and political clout. But it does seem a bit odd to be talking about putting quotas on largely US-based streamers whose primary markets are international outside Australia and relying on them to fulfil the goals of national cultural expression and saying to the commercial broadcasters who are still spending a fortune on sporting rights and stuff, they're not exactly broke, oh, you're off the hook completely, but we think that Netflix is going to tell Australian stories for us all. It just seems quite naive. And of course, not forgetting that our wonderful public service broadcasters also sit outside all current Australian content requirements. So there's nothing to stop the ABC or SBS from stopping doing drama entirely if management decided to reallocate resources somewhere else. Technically, there's nothing to stop that happening.
And is it the case then that the major provider of Australian drama then are the publicly funded broadcasters, the ABC and the Special Broadcasting Service, the SBS?
The ABC and the SBS are the only broadcasters serving national audiences primarily. So obviously the streamers are serving international audiences primarily. And what we found in our research in this report is that the streamers and the ABC and the SBS combined have been spending about the same amount, commissioning around the same hours of Australian drama. So given the ABC is one of Australia's key cultural institutions, then it would be wonderful to see the ABC step up in this space, given the commercial broadcasters have completely abandoned all kind of pro-social obligations in terms of Australian drama.
So we're in a situation, aren't we, where the government is in fact funding the lion's share of Australian drama through these two public broadcasters?
Yes, we are. And in fact, the lion's share of money is actually coming through tax rebates like the producer offset. So yes, the ABC, I think it did about 44 hours last year, SBS probably around 10, are key commissioners. But what's to us in this report is we're quite concerned about is that the producer offset, which is a rebate, a direct back to you cash rebate of 40% of drama's
cost. To encourage
costs,
investment in
to encourage investment and to actually make drama production affordable, because it's Australia's a small to medium-sized television market. High quality content is expensive to make. So the 40% producer offset was meant to deliver cultural value by subsidising drama, but also to help producers build sustainable businesses. And then there's direct money from Screen Australia, and then some of the state organisations like Screen Queensland put in. So Australian drama, or I should say Australian drama that is produced in Australia, because it's not always Australian, gets about half of its budgets back from the taxpayer, which is great if they're really Australian stories that we can all watch. You think, well, there's a trade-off there. But increasingly, these stories are paywalled because they're on streaming services. So the legislation originally in the 70s, when all this stuff came in supporting Australian content, was really about the benefits to the Australian community and stuff should be freely available. But now this drama that is funded is increasingly not accessible to Australian audiences. And of course, you know, a lot of Australians don't even have subscriptions to these services, or may not even have broadband. I mean, we make this assumption that everyone has easy, wonderful broadband access. A lot of households can't afford even broadband. So as central cultural institutions, the ABC and SBS should be really stepping up in this space.
You make the point in your report that policy, government policy, has for too long prioritised industry interests over those of the Australian community.
Yes. I think also we've got to be careful around what we meant by industry interest, because I think there's a really broad range of stakeholders and industry interests. So I think the government has certainly prioritised the interests of the production sector, because a lot of the companies now making Australian drama are actually local branches of multinationals. These aren't struggling producers working out of their kitchens. You know, these are big multinationals that actually dominate supply of Australian drama. And also, when we talk about industry, we talk about commercial broadcasters, because the government's regulatory agenda over the last 15 years appears to have been, we'll do whatever it takes to ensure these businesses survive, rather than we'll do whatever it takes to ensure that Australians have access to Australian content.
The streaming services, of course, would say that they are producing Australian content, but you dispute the value of it in terms of culture and Australian identity, don't you?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So yes, they would argue they're producing Australian content, and they have been investing in Australian content, as in content made in Australia. But sometimes these stories are set in Australia, but they're actually somewhere else. So it's Australia being California or San Francisco or whatever. They're not actually identifiably Australian. or they're these kind of weird stories where you sort of, you hear Australian accents and you see some landmarks, but the two characters are Americans or they're Brits who've just moved out from the UK, or there's nothing actually in the story that locates it in Australia other than some really banal kind of accents and maybe a picture of the Opera House in the background. So there's actually not a lot of value in terms of telling a distinctively Australian story that couldn't just be picked up and plonked another part of the world and the same story could be told.
So looking to the future, I mean, what are your key recommendations to policymakers?
We recommend that funding be made available from the enormous pots of money that currently go into the producer offset and the recently increased location offset to actually invest in this kind of distinctively Australian drama that tells stories that couldn't be located anywhere else. And that doesn't mean, you know, they've got to have koalas and kangaroos and that kind of thing. We're not talking about that at all. We're talking about the Australian equivalent of a story like Mr. Bates versus the Post Office in the UK, you know, the story of how postmasters were treated so dreadfully by the Post Office that really united the country. It became a huge rating success and it highlighted a really serious social issue. So we're talking about those kinds of distinctively Australian stories that couldn't be set anywhere else, that money should be put into those and that they should be freely available. And that means either freely available on the national broadcaster or freely available on YouTube, but a minimum of 50 to 75 hours of new Australian drama that could only be located and only be a story about Australia. We also think that the decision to increase the location offset encourages Australia to become a service industry rather than the generation of Australian stories.
So we're a production house because our labour is cheaper industry. And we've got good facilities for making television.
For now. And we've got good enough incentives that, for now, while the dollar's the way it is, we can compete with Vancouver or Budapest or whatever for now. But, you know, these production companies making all the movie houses, you know, studios, they're scouring the globe looking for the best incentives. The minute the dollar changes or the incentives dial back a bit, they'll go somewhere else. It's not about they intrinsically love to make stuff in Australia. So you're generating these enormous subsidies. Always a lot of talk about all the jobs that have been created as a result. No real analysis of whether those jobs are part-time, full-time, whether they last just for the duration of the shoot or whether they go on for years and years. So, yeah, at the moment, the increase in the location offset looks likely to encourage the development of a service industry as opposed to the creation of Australian IP that can then be monetized around the world. So I think the future is really dire unless we centre public service broadcasters or unless we put some changes into the policy settings. I don't know. I mean, I think if you're going to put content quotas on streamers, you've got to put them on everybody. You've got to put them on commercial broadcasters or you've got to put them on content obligations, I should say. You've got to put them on the ABC and the SBS. You have to have consistency of policy making. You can't just say, well, this group over there get this policy and these over there get another.
Dr. Anna Potter, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And there's a link to Professor Potter's report on the Future Tense website. Next week, as the Olympics get underway in Paris, we look at the influence data analytics and new technologies are having on all kinds of sport.
There's a constant war between the regulator and the corrupt athlete or a corrupt team or the corrupt coach. And the war is they're trying to find some tech that is not discoverable. The regulator wants to find both a means of discovering it and then be able to go out and discover it.
We're just starting to get to that point where a lot of this technology is starting to converge because it's becoming smaller, it's becoming faster, the wireless technology is maturing. And so just at that point where now we're starting to see them overlap because of the technological advancements.
That's technology and the future of sport. Next week on Future Tense. The producer for today's program was Karin Zsivanovits. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time. Cheese.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.